The following presentation is brought to you by God Discussion. For a schedule of upcoming shows, please visit www.goddiscussion.net. Belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. Thomas Paine. The way to see by faith is to shut the eye of reason. Benjamin Franklin. The question before the human race is whether the God of nature shall govern the world by his own laws, or whether priests and kings shall rule it by fictitious miracles. John Adams. It is perfectly evident to my mind that there exists a necessary, eternal, supreme, and intelligent being. This is no matter of faith, but of reason. Voltaire. God gave us reason, not religion. This belief is known as deism. The World Union of Deists, which brings you this podcast, is an international organization dedicated to promoting the message of deism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion, an official podcast of the World Union of Deists. I'm your host, Jason X, and with me tonight is my friend and co-host, Tim Wingate. Last time on God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion, I asserted that we should always do as much good as we can, and we should always do as little evil as we can. Good is treating living creatures the way that they should be treated, and evil is not treating living creatures the way that they should be treated. I also said that utilitarianism, which is the ethical theory that every voluntary human action should attempt to achieve the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of creatures, especially humans, is the best ethical theory. In contrast, Tim believes that, quote, these are Tim's words, we should derive our morality from the examples of nature, as nature is all that we have and is explicit, differing from the anecdotes of man's mind. Good is doing what is best for me and mine without causing injury to others, and evil is causing injury to others without just compensation. A nature-based society with a natural law system is better than utilitarianism because utilitarianism, or variations of it, has historically been paternalistic, hierarchical, and authoritarian, using violence to achieve the greatest good for the greatest number. End quote. Today, we are going to continue to discuss the topic of deism and morality. Deism is a philosophy that teaches only the following two things. One, one should base all of one's beliefs on reason. And two, reason leads one to conclude that God, the being who purposefully created the universe, exists or at least probably exists. That's it. Therefore, deists can believe anything that is reasonable. Some deists will agree with everything that I say about morality, and other deists will disagree with some or all of it. That's okay, though, because God didn't tell me or any other human a bunch of commandments. We have to figure out what is good and what is evil by ourselves, using our reason and learning from and teaching each other. In any case, deists must have a reasonable moral system. Otherwise, they're not deists. Please call this podcast if you have any questions or comments. The more callers, the better. To call, dial 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for a quick phone call because it costs God Discussion more money than the 914 number. That having been said, let me ask Tim some questions. Hi, Tim.
All right. Hey, Jason.
Hey. You said that, quote, we should derive our morality from the examples of nature, as nature is all that we have and is explicit, differing from the anecdotes of man's mind. What would you say is nature?
Well, I would say that nature is what is all around us. It is the physical world collectively, the visible as well as the invisible, subatomic, as well as the macro, like planets and suns. It's natural. Radiation,
and we're part
electromagnetic.
Of nature, right?
Pardon me?
We're part of nature,
pardon
too,
me?
Right?
We are part of nature, yes.
Okay.
Human beings are
part of
nature.
A lot of people make a distinction between humanity and nature, which I think is artificial.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're trying to accomplish, because I've quizzed some people on that, trying to find out if they are believers in the ancient astronaut theory of us being a blend of extraterrestrial beings with some kind of ape that was ape ancestor and produced us. But they seem to not be interested in that. So it's like, well, then how are we separate from nature? Some of the environmentalist folks who even go so far as to say that we're a cancer on Mother Gaia, Mother Earth. And it's like, mm-hmm. Well, no, I don't think so, because if you believe in Darwinism, Darwin's evolution theories, we're a product of nature. So how can we not be nature if we're a product of nature? So, it's everything that's around us. And the thing I want to emphasize is also is that it's the subatomic as well as the macro. That's nature. It's the physical universe, the things that we see and the things we don't see. I don't see radiation. I do see radiation. I see light. But I have a limited amount of radiation that I can perceive visually. We have sound, but I have a limited amount of sound that I can perceive. There's all kinds of things around us all the time we don't see. So I'm including everything, the physical universe, basically.
Okay.
That's nature.
And nature often allows and or causes much suffering. Does that mean that we should allow and or cause much suffering too? Because we're part of nature.
Well,
and you talk about living according to nature.
Yeah. Well, not to get too picky on the structure of your question. Shoulds. I have problems with shoulds because they're used to indicate an obligation, a duty, or correctness. Shoulds imply morality imposed by some authority, and my question is always, well, where do they get the authority? Furthermore, allowing is different than causing. There are many things we have no control over, so we allow it. Suffering is part of nature, and we must accept it and intervene when we desire to do so.
All right. And I was confused by one of your phrases. You said,
sure.
Well, some about anecdotes of man's mind. I'm wondering, what does anecdotes of man's mind mean? I think you should explain it.
All right, I will. You did. You did. You set me up. Okay. Well, quite frankly, it's just what the word means. Anecdote is usually a short narrative or a story that may or may not be true, but it's used often to persuade without evidence, to validate a claim that's being made without evidence. Anecdotal evidence is an informal account of evidence in the form of an anecdote. So it's often used in contrast to, and I use it in contrast specifically, to the scientific evidence or scientific method, because anecdotal evidence usually cannot be investigated using the scientific method. You must either believe or not believe the veracity of the person telling you the story. The problem with arguing based on anecdotal evidence is that anecdotal evidence is not necessarily typical. Only statistical evidence can determine how typical something is. So misuse of anecdotal evidence is in argumentation or in logic is considered an informal fallacy. And
well, you make me think about the difference between objective and subjective. If I were to put this in my own words, as I think you're trying to say, you would say we should strive to base our beliefs on objective reality, not subjective reality, not how we think
feel. Good call.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Now I understand
another wonderful way of saying it. Sure.
Okay, thanks. All right. And I got at least one more question in the short term.
All right.
Why should we base our morality on nature? Well, I guess we already explained this. And not on the antidote to man's
mind. Well, partially.
Mind. Nate, go ahead. I'll let you answer.
Well, because there's more to it than just not relying on subjective, as you called it, subjective stories or non-typical experiences that somebody would relate. Because the reason, quite shortly, is because nature is truth. It mm-hmm. is what it is. It is all that we empirically have. It's what we can see. The physical universe and what is around us is all that we have. The only thing in conflict is the interpretation of nature. What is nature saying in a certain case? Is nature actually saying anything? What is the causality of a situation, as well as what is the result? And then the interpretation, of course, that is where we get into a lot of subjectivity. But that's why the application of reason to the interpretation of nature is paramount, rather than the use of superstition or subjective anecdotal evidence. You know, Jason, we had our friend Dr. Henry Jones on in August talking about this and talking about his book, Psychological Evolution and the Invention of Evil, which, by the way, little plug here. There we go.
Go ahead. Oh, I like plug. The ringer. I did not expect that.
I
can outring you. Wait. Here we go.
Oh.
Let me hit this thing.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
You go
I like
on,
that
though.
One.
You
that
go
one's,
on. I've interrupted
that one's good. But anyway, Henry wrote this wonderful, wonderful book. It is just every time I pick it up and read a bit and put it down and ponder it for a while, it just I'm learning all the time with it. And it's a masterful creation of explaining who we are, why we are the way we are, and what we can do about it if we desire to change.
And
it is available
through the web. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, through World Union of Deists, www.deism.com. Now, I got to give you folks a little warning. It's a little hard to find on the website. So one of the best things to do is you go to the home page and you look over to the left-hand side of the page, and what you will see is a whole list of links in what we would call the main menu there. It's okay. And if you look down the fifth link down, it says Educate Yourself Deist Bookstore. That's what you click on. That will go to, and you just page on down till you hit Deism ebooks/PDF, and you will find that Henry's book, Psychological Evolution and the Invention of Evil, is the fourth book down, and you can go from there and see pick up the book. It's all of 20 Babble bucks, and it is well worth the time to print it out. And I printed it out PDF format and put it in a three-hole punch binder and went from there, and it works real well that way, because I'm not too crazy about reading books online unless I've got a paper background format, you know, like you can get with Kindle online for your computer. It's a little harsh sometimes to do that. Another alternative is to get one of these free software downloads for creating booklets out of PDF files, and you could do that as well. But I just simply wanted to bring the book up, and the reason I wanted to bring that up is that he was talking with us, Jason, about the very basic first part of what he called the super concept, which is the core belief system that everybody develops. Now, before I get there, do you remember what the word epistemology, I can't even say it now, epistemology Do you remember what that word means?
Yeah,
it's a big fancy word.
Epistemology is the study of where people get their beliefs from.
Yeah, yeah. It's a branch of philosophy, and it's how we know truth. It's basically the scientific study of how do we determine what is truth. And what Henry pointed out is that as human beings, we start off as a child trying to figure out our world around us, trying to understand, and we develop a core belief system, a way of measuring what is true and what is not true. And this is a very, very important, because what we're discussing is how we know what is right or wrong, how we know if there is even a right or wrong. We're dealing with a question of morality, and how do we know what is and what is not moral? So Henry says this about the super concept. The source of all data available to every human being is the environment. The environment can be divided into two great areas which both newborns and adult humans face. There is the non-human realm, we will call external reality or nature. There is the human environment, made up of people and their perceptual and conceptual products. Sensations for both these areas are of the environment immediately begin flooding the infant's brain from the moment of birth. Very soon, the infant begins assembling the incoming sensation into precepts. Using these precepts, the infant constructs fantasy world inside of his head. Soon, he's able to conceptualize and thereby becomes conscious of his self. As soon as the infant has a beginning identity and can conceive of his self, he becomes the important entity. He becomes the important entity, the main actor in his evolving mental construction of his fantasy world. Throughout his life, the individual will take information from the two aspects of the environment into his own fantasy world. Now, he's using the term fantasy world as what our imagination, what we make up inside of our head, the filter through which we see things, we perceive things. He applies his imagination to the incoming information to constantly digest and understand and modify and weave into his ever-evolving mental construction. This worldview contains a standard of truth for the non-contradictory cognition. This is the person's super concept. So basically, Henry is pointing out, and he goes into a lot more depth, is that cognition is the process of the mind, and we have two ways that our mind cognitates. The first one is observation. The second one is imagination. Imagination is, of course, is what comes from within, what we perceive, how we interpret it. Imagination comes also from other people, your parents, your religious institution, your school, other people, the group, what they say reality is, their interpretations of the things that we see around us may be different than what we actually observe. And so you have observation and imagination. Personal observation, of course, is individualistic, and group-imposed imagination tends to be collectivist, and this is the constant battle throughout mankind's history, the individual versus the collective, how the two can enmesh, or distance themselves from each other. Now, as I said, back to my original statement that observation using reason being something that has been developed in a super concept that is based on observation testing a variation of the scientific method. The super concept, as opposed to superstitious beliefs of imagination rather than beliefs based on observable nature. Basically, the super concept or the standard of truth derived from the observation of nature is better than superstitious conceptualization of anecdotal imaginations.
So it's better to
answer your question.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. It's
okay,
better to have a concept of reality based on reason than to have one based on something other than reason, say like tradition or mythology. Okay, I just want to make sure that I was understanding, because there was a lot of fancy language in there.
Yeah. Well, I figured you were up to it.
Oh, I am. I understand everything, of course. I'm just doing this for the benefit of our listeners.
There we go. There we go.
Sigmund Freudish, and I just wanted to make sure.
We can boil it down and make it. You boiled it down very well. It's basically reason, and the question always comes. And we started this when we first started this series was, what is reason? How do we reason? These things are still part of the discussion when we say the term, oh, that's reasonable. Well, what is reason? How do you determine that? And, of course, we talked before about inductive and deductive reasoning or a blend of the two, how we do that. So that's really what we're struggling with, because as deists, I agree with you. We want to have a moral and ethical standard of living, and how we are interacting within our society. And it's important that we discuss these issues and that everybody comes to their own conclusions on what these things are.
Yep. Well, are you up for one more question, or is there something more you wanted to say in regard to the last
one? No. No.
Time for a new one, huh? Okay. You said that, quote, a nature-based society with a natural law system is better than utilitarianism, because utilitarianism, or variations of it, have historically been paternalistic, hierarchical, and authoritarian, using violence to achieve the greatest good, or whatever they consider the greatest good, for the greatest number, end quote. Tim, would you please give a few examples of such violent, paternalistic, hierarchical, and authoritarian attempts to achieve the greatest good for the greatest number?
Well, that's a great question, Jason, and I appreciate you for asking that. I will strive to answer that question. It's complex, and there's a lot to it, actually. But what I want people to understand is that you and I are both what we would call consequentialists.
Uh-huh.
Utilitarianism is a branch of consequentialism. And consequentialism is a class of what is called normative ethical theories that hold that the consequences of one's conduct are the ultimate basis for any judgment about the rightness of that conduct. Thus, from a consequentialist standpoint, a moral right act or omission is one that will produce a good outcome or consequence. So our duties are actions within or according to consequentialism fall into a couple categories: preventing suffering or harm, not inflicting harm or pain on oneself or others. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Prevent suffering or harm by not inflicting harm or pain on oneself or others. Preventing the infliction of suffering on oneself or others. Doing positive good for yourself or others by making people happier or their lives more pleasurable. That's the basic concept of consequentialism. Yeah, and that's the basic concept. And out of that, John Stuart Mill then went on and developed more of the utilitarian ethic.
And
so
Jeremy
with
Bentham
all
before,
that in,
Bentham came before
pardon
Mill.
Me?
Jeremy Bentham came before Mill. He's the one, I think, who coined the term utilitarianism, and then Mill sought to refine it.
Yes, he did. Exactly. In fact, Bentham's the one who greatest good for the greatest number. He's one of those guys who started that. So with that in mind, understanding that there's, you know, we're both consequentialists, but it's how we interpret that and where the differences lie. And what I would like to do is bring up what I believe is an overarching basic premise for life's consequential operation. And I appreciate the use of your term voluntary, that you use that, because voluntary implies somebody is doing something out of their own free will and not out of coercion. I believe in what is called the non-aggression principle, or
okay, great.
NAP.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment. I remember that you gravitated to that word. I thought, oh, maybe he didn't understand what I meant by voluntary. Oh, what I meant is we have voluntary and involuntary actions. I voluntarily am talking on the phone right now. I could hang up if I wanted to. But I have an involuntary action. My heart's beating. I'm breathing. I can hold my breath for a little bit, but eventually I'm going to breathe again. You know, if you hit me on the knee just right, my knee will jerk up. That's an involuntary action. So I think we're both using the word voluntary correctly, but we're using it with different definitions. I just wanted to bring that up before you proceed.
Okay, well, that's fine. I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying as far as the term of voluntary. I think that falls under that it's something that is of your own volition. It's something that you choose to do. And
oh, yes. But you were using it. My spider sense is telling me that you're going to take it in a different direction than
Not entirely, but I'm going to expand on it, and that is the non-aggression principle. It's a moral stance that it's just basically a moral stance that asserts that aggression is inherently illegitimate no matter if the result of those actions is beneficial, neutral, or damaging to the owner. It's an overarching principle.
All right, I'm hearing you.
And so it's the result of this or the consequence is secondary to the principle of non-aggression. That aggression is inherently illegitimate no matter if the result of those actions is beneficial, neutral, or damaging to the owner.
When these actions are like you and I say, as long as the result is what we would consider good, then aggression is fine. So, for example, if there's a bully picking on me and I tried all kinds of reasonable ways to stop him, then it's okay for me to punch him in the nose.
Well, that is part of the non-aggression principle, is that it's not pacifistic.
But just the word non-aggression kind of sounded pacifistic to me.
Well, you have to understand that aggression is something that is that you use the threat of force or coercion in any form to obtain a result. And it is still aggression, regardless of your, you know, I'm doing this for your own good. Come here, Jason. I'm giving you a spanking. It's for your own good. No, it's still aggression.
So so now you're talking about, I think what you're saying is that you're talking about something like a government. It's not good for a government to be aggressive toward the people it governs.
Well, a government is nothing more than a collection of individuals. Why do I, as an individual, have a right to be aggressive toward you and use aggression, the threat of violence, the coercive effect of either mental or physical violence against you to get you to do something that I want? Whether it's beneficial to you or not is irrelevant.
Is that a hypothetical question?
No, it's not hypothetical.
All right. Well, I believe in democracy. I'd say that governments derive their just powers by the consent of the governed, and people do stuff like elect governmental leaders who will hire policemen to make sure that the community is safer.
Well, democracy is, you know, quite often two wolves and a lamb voting on what they're going to have for dinner.
Two wolves and a lamb.
That's Benjamin Franklin who used that example.
Yeah,
democracy
well,
is
I,
not
I
anything
say,
great.
Say,
in fact,
I
the founding fathers
that.
Were against democracy. They didn't believe in democracy. They did believe in the right to a limited right to vote and majority ruling in that vote, but I'm not sure that they actually believed in democracy. See, we've redefined democracy to basically mean some form of representative voting. And that's not what democracy actually meant. We've changed the words, the meanings over a period of time. But let me just finish with this thing with the non-aggression principle, is that by applying the non-aggression principle in life. It's as an overarching thing. It affects everything. It affects all the decisions. It affects all the having trouble with that word. But the consequentialism. It affects that.
It is a tongue twister.
Yeah, I know. It's a mouthful, isn't it? You know. Well, when actions are against the owner's free will, it interferes with a person's right to self-determination and the principle of self-ownership. I mean, that really comes down to it. Do I own myself or not? Do you own yourself or not?
I would say you do. I would say I do.
Well, then, so aggression, coercive aggression against you in any form is not respecting your right to self-ownership and your own self-determination and what you're going to do with your own property, meaning you.
Hey, Tim, I want you to hold that thought because it's worth coming back to. We're going to have a slight commercial break. It's going to kind of be a weird commercial because I just might read it. First, for station identification, let's see if I can find this thing. There we go.
God's a big subject. By sharing our stories, we can understand why we believe or not believe, and maybe even find some common ground. From free thought to Christianity, deism to world religions, we have something for you. Our guests include authors, philosophers, scientists, preachers, activists, and folks who have been affected by religious belief in a good or bad way. Log on to goddiscussion.net for our show schedules. There's an at-a-glance calendar there and info on our various hosts and programs. Again, that's goddiscussion.net.
Be sure to join us right here on November 4th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for a special episode of God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion. Tim Wingate and I will be interviewing Linda, the World Union of Deists contact person for Scotland. On the morning of Thursday, July 7th, 2005, Islamic terrorists detonated four bombs aboard three trains and one double-decker bus in London, England. As well as the four suicide bombers, 52 civilians were killed and over 700 more were injured. One of those 700 injured was Linda, who is now confined to a wheelchair for life. Linda was a lapsed Christian then, or at least I think so, but this tragedy propelled her to become an active deist because she realized through both painful personal experience and rational reflection, that those who believe in the absurdities can easily commit atrocities. Please tell all your friends and family to listen to her tragic and inspiring story. Since this is a live podcast, they can even ask her questions directly. Reason fixes problems, but faith causes problems, some of them very deadly. Once again, this is Jason X here, along with my co-host Tim Wingate. I am the Deputy Director of the World Union of Deists. The World Union of Deists is an educational organization dedicated to teaching the world about deism so that humanity will be as sane, good, and happy as possible. Our website address is www.deism.com. That's www.deism.com. We would love to have you call in. Either dial 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for a quick phone call because it costs God Discussion more money than the 914 number. All right, Tim, you were talking about how human beings own themselves and the moral implications of this belief.
Well, right, and really what I'm trying to do is get back to answering your original question of, giving some examples of violent, paternalistic, hierarchical, authoritarian attempts to achieve the greatest good for the greatest number. And what I was trying to do is lead with this overarching concept that I believe in, that I know many people around the world believe in, and that's called the non-aggression principle. And let me just reiterate it, and then I'll move in. It's a moral stance that asserts aggression is inherently illegitimate, no matter if the result of those actions of that aggression is beneficial, neutral, or damaging to the owner. When those actions are against the owner's free will, it interferes with his right to self-determination or the principle of self-ownership. In contrast with pacifism, the non-aggression principle does not preclude violence used in self-defense or in the defense of others. My contention would be that if the non-aggression principle had been part of the following societies that we will discuss in answer to your question, the horrendous history of those societies may not have occurred. Now, specifically, I'm going to
talk a little bit about... Excuse me, I'll be right with you. You said that you were a consequentialist, but are you just like a limited consequentialist when this... non-aggression principle conflicts with the consequentialist principle? Do you just go with the non-aggression principle?
I go with it's the overarching principle. Consequentialism is the form I guess would be, yeah, it's limited. I'm not deriving a moral or a morality out of the consequence. The consequence determine whether it's moral or not. And consequentialism is not just, well, you know, what happens, and if it's for my good or not. The fact that, you know, you have these consequences, not really explaining it well, but the NAP principle is the overarching principle. So the consequence that we would want to have is non-aggression on the part of everyone respecting each other's personal property, and that is themselves.
All right.
Now, you had asked specifically, you know, name some societies. Well, we could get into a whole lot, but let's just deal with the societies that adopted Marxist collectivism in all the various forms, you know, such as the Soviet Union, China, Cambodia, North Korea, Cuba. You could take a look at some of the Eastern Bloc nations. They all adopted some form of Marxism, Marxist ethics. And Marxist ethics are unarguably utilitarian. To Marxist, action.
I would say that at least one person would argue with you about it, but keep on going.
Well, you might, but that's all right.
I'll give you two: Bentham and Jason. Go ahead.
Well, okay. You know, I could. This is what I learned.
Go on. Yeah.
And over a period of years of observing and living life, et cetera, my anecdotal stories, okay? To Marxists, the acceptable action in class morality is whatever it takes to accomplish the ultimate goal, namely a classless communist society. Utilitarianism, the end justifies the means. Freedom can be achieved only when all class barriers are erased. Therefore, anything that serves.
Here.
All right.
The goal of a communist society, you know, probably is to have a classless society. But the goal of utilitarianism is not necessarily to have a classless society. It's to have the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest number.
Well, okay. Good point. The fact is that they utilized utilitarian principles to carry out their communist or their Marxist goals. And
so,
that
so you're saying
is
that because they didn't, because they didn't emphasize individual rights enough, because they were focused so much on the welfare of society rather than the
but
the
utilitarianism
rights of
the in and of itself doesn't necessarily do that. You have all forms of utilitarianism. And different and
well,
over
well,
period
I would,
of time, over history. Well,
beings,
Jason, I'm just trying to answer your question.
Oh,
the
go,
society,
go ahead,
you want to know what societies? Take your pick of most of the Marxist societies that have existed in the 20th century. That's really, you know, that's all you got to do, because Marxism in and of itself supposedly is supposed to serve the higher good. The problem is that under Marxism, you can justify mistreating your neighbor by claiming it'll serve the higher good in the long run. Ivan Barani, a Ukrainian citizen, estimated that the Soviets killed 10 million of his countrymen between 1927 and 1939. And he stated the problem this way: the party clique, which follows the slogan expressed by the saying, "the end justifies the means," is actually always ready to use any means. And in the case of the Ukrainians, the means included shooting, starvation, and slave labor in Siberia. Joseph Stalin referred to this action as the liquidation of the kulak class. Lenin admitted that the proletariat would be willing to work with the petty bourgeois proprietors as long as those proprietors' work furthered the Marxist cause. But afterwards, the roads would part, and we shall have to engage in the most decisive, ruthless struggle against them. Now, most people don't know who the kulak class was, but it was wealthier, prosperous peasants in a local area. They maybe owned a farm and had some cattle and horses. They could employ people. They were the local rich guy who had a business or a farm and actually employed people and lent them money. Now, some of them were bad. Many of them were good. The Soviet government undermined the kulak's position by organizing committees of poor peasants to administer the villages and to supervise the requisitioning of grain from the richer peasants. In other words, collectivism. In 1927, the Soviet government began to shift its peasant policy by increasing the kulak's taxes, restricting their rights to lease land, and in 1929, it began a drive for rapid collectivization of agriculture. The kulaks vigorously opposed the efforts to force them to give up their small privately owned farms and to join large cooperative agricultural establishments. At the end of 1929, a campaign to liquidate the kulaks as a class, de-kulakization, was launched by the Soviet government. By 1934, when approximately 75% of the farms in the Soviet Union had been collectivized, most kulaks, as well as millions of other peasants who had opposed collectivization, had been deported to the remote regions of Siberia of the Soviet Union or arrested and their land and property confiscated. Stalin basically took Lenin's philosophy to heart, stating, and I quote Joseph Stalin, "to put it briefly, the dictatorship of the proletariat is the domination of the proletariat over the bourgeoisie, untrammeled by law and based on violence, enjoying the sympathy and support of the toiling and exploited masses." A British journalist, Mr. D.G. Stuart Smith, estimated that the international communism over a period of time is responsible for 83 million deaths between 1917 and 1964. From a Marxist-Leninist perspective, if 83 million died to abolish social classes and private property, it was worth the price, even morally just. Marxists judge the results, not the methods. Stalin, therefore, acted always within the Marxist-Leninist ethical code. He used means that he assumed would serve his ends, the destruction of the class enemy. And should those ends ever be accomplished, Marxists would have to applaud Stalin as a Marxist with the proper concept of morality.
All right.
We
well,
could go further. We could actually
no,
go
no,
further
no, no,
on
no.
that.
No, I have a question for you.
All right.
Tim, who do you believe was happier during the Cold War, the average American or the average Soviet?
It doesn't make any difference. Why?
But it does.
What difference does it? How would I know that? How would I know that?
Well, take a guess.
How would I know that, Jason? Come on. Give me a reasonable way on how I would know that.
Well, have you ever studied history? Have you ever lived in the United States?
Well, yes, but that doesn't – if you can cite to me a scientifically verifiable sampling, you know, scientific sampling of a population during that time of the so-called Cold War, of the populations of both either the Soviet Union and the United States, and maybe we could talk about that. But up to this at this point, it'd be nothing more than my fantasy.
Whatever
I come up with my imagination based on my prejudices.
Based on no specific scientific study, would be that the average American was happier than the average Soviet, and that's one of the reasons why communists in general have tried to become capitalists like Americans. So as a utilitarian, I would say that the American system was the better system than the Soviet system, because the American system promoted more happiness.
That doesn't change the fact that communism or Marxism utilized utilitarian principles to achieve or attempt to achieve their ends.
There are all kinds of consequentialists. Not every consequentialist is a utilitarian. A consequentialist could be someone like a Nazi. A Nazi can say,
Now we're going to argue about how Christians are. Which denomination is going to be really following the word of God? It ends up being an exercise in futility, because it ends up just being everybody's own opinion no matter what. So what's the point of trying to arrive at some kind of ethical definition if we're going – I just find it futile to speculate on the hypotheticals when we do have history that shows that not only – the Marxist regimes of the 20th century, but also the National Socialist regimes of the 20th century, were very utilitarian in their justification for what they did, for the atrocities that they did.
Well,
and that includes Nazi Germany.
I would say that they may have been consequentialists, but they weren't utilitarians. There are many different types of consequentialists.
Well, you're trying to define utilitarianism. Almost in a million, millions, or not, I'm not saying million, kind of like John Stuart Mill with all of his rules. Let's just put it that way. You're trying to really define what utilitarianism is, but who are you to define what utilitarianism is? Anybody can look up, can Google it, can Bing it, can do their own study on what utilitarianism is, and it's a philosophical, ethical system that is a variation or comes out of consequentialism, but there's no absolute definition as to what utilitarianism is. So
there are different types of utilitarianism. For example, there's Benthamite utilitarianism, and there's that of Mills. If you're wondering what kind I follow, I'm over Benthamite. He kept it simple.
Okay.
Jeremy Bentham said that whatever gives the most happiness to the most people is good, and whatever doesn't isn't. And he said, and what John Stuart Mill tried to do was try to make it a little bit fancier. Bentham said that one form of happiness is as good as another, and then Mill said, no, not really. There's higher pleasures, like Shakespeare.
Yeah,
The Simpsons. And I think that's a little bit elitist, and that unnecessarily complicates it all. So I follow the Bentham strand of utilitarianism, and I'd say that whatever system gives the most happiness to the most people is good, and whatever doesn't. And of course, in the case of the Cold War, I'd say that the American system was more utilitarian in that sense, and that's the only sense that I talk about it and try to live it, than the, compared to the Soviet sense.
Well, I'm not going to disagree that the Americans and we ended up more or less, but then take a look at our system. I could go through the 10 planks of the Marxist Communist Manifesto and show how all 10 planks are in use right now today in American society. We've adopted a lot of socialist collectivism. We may not call it that, but that's what we're doing. So there's been a movement both directions, and I'm not sure that this is part of the problem with utilitarian arguments, is that it's always either or. It's always a dichotomous argument, one or the other, and it's usually a hypothetical situation that really doesn't deal with real life. Real life was life in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany at the time. And there are many people that loved living in the Soviet Union. Now, I don't know how many, but there were many that were.
This is a new story to me.
Well, see, accepting the propaganda that everybody hated the Soviet Union is preposterous. They didn't. People didn't hate the Soviet Union. They hated discomfort. They hated long lines. But if you were part of the upper class in the so-called classless society, you had it pretty good. And there were many people who believed in the concept of the classless society and the new Soviet man. They had many people like that. Not everybody, obviously. And when it became unsustainable and things became more miserable, of course the people started to look toward different options and different ways of doing things. And of course, those of us who were paying attention at the time in the 80s and when the wall fell, the Berlin Wall fell, and perestroika and detente started to come into play, and the Soviet Union was basically dismantled itself, primarily because of economic issues. People picked up and moved on and went into other directions. I wouldn't say that they're purely capitalist by any means. I'm not even sure that pure capitalism is a good way to go. I mean, we're not totally capitalist. We say we are, but we're not. We're more of a corporatist in our society right now, especially the way that our government runs. It's more corporatist than it is capitalist. The capitalists are the owners of the corporations, whether they're stockholders or the people who run the corporations.
Well, it seems to me that the best way is usually somewhere between two extremes. At one extreme,
well, I would agree.
You've got one extreme, and what we're talking about is the desires of the state, the desires of the government. And at the other extreme is the desire of the individual. And it seems to me that governments should, you know, allow people to do whatever they want as long as they don't obviously hurt someone else. But then there are certain things that individuals have to do for their government. Every now and then I see something about Hasidic Jews in Israel who refuse to fight in their nation's government, in their nation's army, and yet they want the benefits of living in that society. And the irony is that at least some of them say that they don't want to fight for Israel because it wasn't established by the Messiah, so it shouldn't be around. If I was a more secular Jew, I'd say, well, then get out. You know, people who live here should do certain things, like follow certain laws, like don't steal, don't murder. You get drafted, fight for the nation, unless you've got a real good reason not to.
Yeah. Well, as long as a person has an opportunity there.
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I had a click on my line. I thought it was something else.
Well,
anyway,
gears
as long as a person has an opportunity, it's the NSA listening in. There we go.
As long as a person has an opportunity, don't be mean to me.
as long as a person has an opportunity to opt out without negative consequences, I don't have a problem with somebody opting out. The problem is that government, as it tends to be today, is monopolistic. They claim a monopoly on the use of force, a monopoly on basically on what is right and what is wrong.
And of course, government's made of people, and people are imperfect. So, you know, that we government,
right.
The power of government needs to be limited.
Right, but the point is still. There are societies throughout history. We could go back even further in history. We could go to the Roman Empire. We could go which utilized, before they were even called utilitarian principles, but they used utilitarian principles to do what they did. There's been any number of societies and empires that have used the premises of the end justifies the means and the greatest good for the greatest number. It's history.
And I wish that you had used the word consequentialist, because I would say probably very few Roman leaders were ever utilitarian. It's more honest to say consequentialist.
Well, that's your definition of utilitarian. If you're taking
Jeremy Bentham's definition, he's the one who founded it.
Well, but that he doesn't – just because he started the word utilitarian doesn't mean he was the originator of the ideas. I mean, Epicurus was the one who started the business of wanting, or having, the desire. People look for pleasure and happiness, and the thing that's undesirable is pain and unhappiness. You know, that's Epicurus. These ideas aren't new, Jason. They've been around for thousands of years of recorded human history. So, you know, you can be a Benthamite, that's fine. But it's not exclusive. And the term utilitarianism, if it's still going to be the greatest good for the greatest number, is the primary...
The greatest happiness. But okay, fine.
Greatest happiness.
Here's an interesting aside.
Okay.
I just want to throw it out there, because... I've been reading a guy called Robert Ingersoll. Have you ever heard of him, Tim?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was known as like the
big humanist.
Agnostic. Yeah. He was a humanist and agnostic. And he made an assertion that I've been thinking about. He said that there is no good but happiness. And I just want to throw that out to any listeners out there before Tim and I get back to our discussion. Listeners out there, is there any other good but happiness? Give us a call and let us know. I'm curious. I want to know, because I've been thinking about this and thinking about this, and I think maybe not. Or that's in any case, that's a very powerful statement. Back to you, Tim.
Well, if I was a cannibal and happiness was a warm thigh cooked to the right temperature.
Yeah, it wouldn't be too good for the owner of the thigh, though.
There you go. And that's part of the problem with that. But anyway.
Yeah.
I feel I answered your question.
Yeah, I think you did too. I think it was a good discussion.
Okay.
All right. why don't we get back to this book that I wrote called Expanded Deism, and I got a section called Moral Fundamentals. I ask questions and I answer the questions. It's like a catechetical. It is a catechetical structure, but then again, I'm an excommunicated priest, so if I can't do a catechetical structure, who can? All right,
anyways, another ex-priest.
There's a few of us out there.
Or ex-minister, how's that?
Oh, that's true, that's right. All right, anyways, I asked the question, how should living creatures be treated? And I answer the question, usually we should obey the utilitarian rule. Always try to make every voluntary action you do achieve the greatest amount of happiness, the greatest amount of creatures, especially humans. And, Tim, if you ever feel like interrupting, please do. All right. All right. Why is it called the utilitarian rule? Are you interrupting?
I'm sorry.
Press your bell.
I was interrupting.
Press your bell. I want to hear it.
Oh,
okay, go ahead.
There we go.
All right, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, you're the one who's going to ask the question. That was an interruption. Okay. All right, why is it called the utilitarian rule? Simply speaking, utilitarianism is the ethical theory that every voluntary human action should attempt to achieve the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of creatures, especially humans. I wrote simply speaking because there are different types of utilitarianism. Oh, and by the way, I want to just say something. Earlier, I basically said that if a government derives its powers from the consent of the governed, and the government decides to go to war for whatever reason, I said, and it drafts people, I said that it's the duty of the citizens to serve in the military at that time. What I didn't say, which I should have said, I meant to, was that I think for people who believe the war is wrong or people who are pacifists, if they get drafted, they should be in non-combat roles, maybe serving as medics or nurses, maybe as supply officers. So that way they're not avoiding their duty to their nation, but they also are not directly involved in the killing that's going on. That thought was working on one side of my brain as I was reading the book. All right, time to move on. Okay. Why should we usually obey the utilitarian rule? It is supported by fundamental and very common human beliefs, such as that happiness is good, we should have as much happiness as possible, humans should be given equal consideration, we should be kind to all sentient creatures, and most non-sentient creatures should be allowed to live. I should say here, a sentient creature is a creature that can feel pain. Also, it is an understandable, rational, and consistent rule that can be successfully applied to most, if not all, situations.
All right. You know, one of the problems I have with utilitarianism is that the use of the normative terms, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean by moral?
I mean, what does normative mean?
Well, the terms good and bad are really only make sense in the context of society. And something,
be it
in an action, a law, or an ideology, it's morally good only as far as it promotes human happiness or satisfaction. I don't know that there is we could determine a morality in and of itself that stands apart from our interaction with it. But because the nature of human interaction is social cooperation, it's the means by which we learn to satisfy our different subjective desires and ends. And so ethical issues can be reduced to, you know, to the expected strengthening or weakening of social bonds. So basically what promotes cooperation is good, and what hinders it is bad.
Well, you're replacing the word happiness with cooperation. Those two are not necessarily the same thing.
I think some cooperation leads to happiness. I mean, you're talking before about conscription. And, you know, if there's non-cooperation with that conscription, there's going to be unhappiness. This is the problem with the, you know, we talk about Jefferson's point in the Declaration of Independence that governments are formed among men with the consent of the governed.
Beautiful phrase.
By the consent of the governed. The problem is that governments have grown beyond the point where people can give knowledgeable consent. They're also not able to refuse consent. It is assumed just because you live here, therefore you are obligated by some invisible social contract, you have an obligation to perform. And I've often said, well, where did I sign that contract?
Is an important concept. In fact, I want to talk about it.
It's a fallacy. It's a fraud.
I want to talk about it after this commercial break.
Okay.
all right, here we go.
God's a big subject. By sharing our stories, we can understand why we believe or not believe, and maybe even find some common ground. From free thought to Christianity, deism to world religions, we have something for you. Our guests include authors, philosophers, scientists, preachers, activists, and folks who have been affected by religious belief in a good or bad way. Log on to goddiscussion.net for our show schedules. There's an at-a-glance calendar there and info on our various hosts and programs. Again, that's goddiscussion.net.
Be sure to join us right here on November 4th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for a special episode of God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion. Tim Wingate and I will be interviewing Linda, the World Union of Deists contact person for Scotland. On the morning of Thursday, July 7th, 2005, Islamic terrorists detonated four bombs aboard three trains and one double-decker bus in London, England. As well as the four suicide bombers, 52 civilians were killed, and over 700 more were injured. One of those 700 injured was Linda, who is now confined to a wheelchair for life. Linda was a lapsed Christian then, or at least that's what I think. But this tragedy propelled her to become an active deist because she realized, through both painful personal experience and rational reflection, that those who believe in absurdities can easily commit atrocities. Please tell all your friends and family to listen to her tragic and inspiring story, since this is a live podcast. They can even ask her questions directly. Reason fixes problems, but faith causes problems, some of them very deadly. Hello again. This is Jason X, along here with my co-host, Tim Wingate. I am the Deputy Director of the World Union of Deists. The World Union of Deists is an educational organization dedicated to teaching the world about deism, so that humanity will be as sane, good, and happy as possible. Our website address is www.deism.com. That's www.deism.com. We would love to have you call in. Either dial 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for a quick phone call because it costs God Discussion more money than the 914 number. Tim, would you be kind enough to explain to us what the social concept is? No, what is the word? Social contract. What the social
contract?
Is. Yeah.
Well, I'm not really prepared to deal with all of that, but basically the concept is that the social contract is the Constitution. Constitution is a social contract between by the people with the government. And a social contract in general would be the rules by which we all agree to live by, and we're obligated to each other to follow those rules. Whether it's traffic laws, a good example would be traffic issues, traffic laws. We all agree to drive on the same side of the road, you know, the right side of the road, as opposed to being in England where you drive on the left side of the road. We have different kinds of social contracts. They can be etiquette or other forms of just general behavior, or they can be legal issues. And primarily the concept of the social contract in dealing with government and in our country specifically is the social contract of the Constitution. And there are many out there who would argue that the Constitution is not a viable nor a legal social contract, but it is acted as if it is by a monopolistic group of hirelings who have gathered lots of power to themselves and are now telling the people for whom supposedly the Constitution was constructed, and that is the people, it was constructed by the people, for the people, supposedly, to control and keep the government in check. And now the government has become the arbiter of not only what is good and evil, but what you can and cannot do. So there's a whole lot.
Let me just interject something here before you, you go on. My understanding is that the term social contract was promoted, if not coined, by John Locke, who was an Englishman. I think he lived at about, 1750. And a lot of our founding fathers, such as Thomas Jefferson, were big fans of John Locke and the idea of the social contract. And I'm not necessarily disagreeing with anything that you just said there, Tim, but the idea is of the social contract is that to belong to a society, there are certain rules you have to follow. And so individuals give up some of their liberties to belong to a society to in order to get more benefits than they would if they lived alone, say like on a deserted island or in a cave. That's my understanding of it all.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying is that social concepts have evolved, just like the founding fathers were products of the Enlightenment, which had been an ongoing evolution of human thought. So, I don't want to be stuck back in the 18th century with social concepts, but the idea what you just espoused is basically true. The only caveat to that is does a person have the ability to opt out of that social contract? And this is where we're having a fair amount of divisiveness now in our country, is that we are being told by the government that you will do certain things a certain way, and if you don't, you'll be punished. And the excuse is you have representative government, you have consent of the governed, and so therefore you will do whatever we tell you to do. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like it, vote us out. Which is nearly impossible these days with all the changes that have been made to pad and support a government position. So we no longer have a level playing field.
The propaganda.
Yes,
too.
Yeah, the propaganda that goes on as well. So I really didn't want to get into a whole political type of issue here. But we're back, still got to get back to the issue of good and bad, and what do we determine is good and bad, and is it just based on pleasure and happiness, or what? And I guess the thing that I have, the problem I have with utilitarianism in all of its variations, is that good and bad have kind of lost their special, an ethical character to them. Mm-hmm. Now they're so relative, and it's pretty much up in the air. And I kind of, jokingly said at the beginning, if I'm a cannibal and, a nice cooked thigh is what makes me happy and gives me pleasure, well, there you go. Is that good? I don't know. Can we say that that's good just because I have happiness and pleasure eating your thigh? What about you? You're missing a thigh. How are you going to play rugby with only one leg?
I play rugby out there, folks. I'm a flanker. That's my position. I think the social contract fits in well with utilitarianism because, people...
I would agree with you there.
Because people decide to live together in society to try to maximize their happiness. And I think that it'd be very difficult to have a society that maximizes happiness where cannibalism was allowed, especially on the living.
I understand what you're saying, but there have been whole societies that have been cannibalistic. And it was ritualized, and so, you stayed in good graces, so you weren't dinner next week, I guess,
Sometimes cannibalism is an act of reverence. Sometimes people would eat a little bit of their relatives to have them be a part of them. It's gross. I don't condone it, but not all cannibalism is cruel.
Is cool or cruel?
Cruel. C-R-U.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if it's cruel, it's not cool. Maybe no cannibalism is cool.
All right.
Let me just
throw this then in, is that I see as a fundamental problem with utilitarianism is that despite a succession of, and I include you in the group of ingenious proponents.
Well, thank you.
The advocates of utilitarianism have yet to explain why the individual should behave morally. The fact that we're all better off if we behave morally is utterly true, but it's irrelevant. The truly difficult moral issues that I see that we deal with is like the prisoner's dilemma. Are you familiar with the prisoner's dilemma?
I've heard it, I've read it, but I forgot. Can you refresh our memories?
Basically, the individual does better by exploiting others.
Right.
It's basically the prisoner's dilemma. It's an example of game theory, and it shows why two individuals might not cooperate, even though it appears it'd be in their best interest to do so. There's some rules and some qualifications to this logical dilemma, but basically two members of a gang are arrested and imprisoned, and each prisoner is isolated from the other one, so they have no means of communicating with each other. The police admit they don't have enough evidence to convict the pair on the principal charge. They plan to sentence both to a year in prison on a lesser charge. But they offer each prisoner simultaneously a plea bargain. If A and B, prisoner A, prisoner B, both confessed the crime, they each serve 2 years in prison. If A confesses and flips on B, or vice versa, A will be set free, and B will serve 3 years. If A and B both deny the crime, both of them will only serve 1 year in prison. Now, remember, neither one of them knows what the other one is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where, what's the best for me? What's the happiest thing for me? Not what is true, what did we really do, what's the best thing? Because betraying your partner by confessing always rewards more than cooperating with them, the police. All purely rational, self-interested prisoners would betray the other. So the only possible outcome for the two purely rational prisoners is for both of them to betray each other. The interesting part of this results is that the pursuing individual reward logically leads both of the prisoners to betray. So actually, they'd get a better reward if they both cooperated with each other rather than with the authorities, but they can't because they are isolated. And so what it does is that it shows that people, at least in this game theory construct, tend to display a systematic bias toward cooperative behavior. And people run all kinds of predictions and they, computer programs and all this kind of stuff trying to figure out, this is what game theory is, predicting what people are going to do at any time in a given situation. And so they come up with all kinds of different situations and try and use that predictability to determine what is going to be done or how something is going to be constructed. Well, this is the problem that I find is that why should I, as an individual, go along? Why am I morally compelled? What's the morality that I'm compelled to follow? According to a utilitarian-based society, why should I behave morally?
Yeah, dang nabbit, I didn't start the timer. There we go. Okay, timer for the next commercial. Let's make that. We're gonna do that 10 minutes. Sorry. Hold on here. This is a small operation. Okay. Well, you know what, Tim? I think you're a good person. I think you're the type of person that if there was a house on fire and a baby who was going to be burned alive, you'd be willing to risk your life to rescue the baby. I think you are. And I hope, and a lot of times I feel like I'm that type
of
person.
Yes, I'd be willing to, yes. I would hope I'm the type who would look at the situation and assess whether or not I could realistically attempt, did I have a good chance at rescuing the baby? And yes, I'll trespass on that property, even though there are signs up there that says don't do it. And if the police are there trying to stop me from doing it, I would try and evade them and get around to try and save the baby. Much like the father who was arrested by police who stopped him from going in and actually doing that to his own child. Not too long ago.
He was arrested by the police for trying to rescue his child?
Yep. Yep.
Was this in the U.S.?
Yeah, this is in the U.S., yeah. It's within the last month.
That's crazy. I'd like to know all the details of that. But
I'll see if I can find it again.
I'd rather die trying to rescue my child than live having not tried. That's me. But when you and I talk, Tim, I think that we talk from the perspective of two very broad camps. One camp, and I'm trying to find the words that fit, and for your camp, I'm going to say a word that most people would think was negative. If you can think of a better word, let me know. I don't mean any offense whatsoever. But I think I talk from an egalitarian point of view. I'm saying that all people are of equal worth, and therefore, I should treat people the way I want to be treated. That's how I address the prisoner dilemma. I'm going to treat that guy the way I want to be treated. Now, if he's guilty, I don't remember all the details, but if he's guilty, I'll say he's guilty. If I'm guilty, well, maybe I'll just say I'm guilty. If we're both guilty, I don't know. You got to tell me all the scenarios and such. But I wouldn't try to stick it to him because I believe that person is of equal worth as I am. And I contrast egalitarianism with self-centeredness. There are some people who just think about themselves, and that type of person would be willing to horribly punish someone who didn't deserve to be punished just to get off the hook, or even just to make a dollar. And I often contrast utilitarianism with objectivism. Would you consider yourself an objectivist, Tim?
No, not at all. I'm not a randroid.
Well, I know Rand was an atheist, and you're a deist, but
I wouldn't say I go along with that at all. No, I consider myself a naturalist. As you know, we haven't even gotten into looking at nature. What does nature teach us? These issues. I think that's we're trying to deal with some. Nebulous ethical concepts, and we're trying to create some constructs to help define good and evil. And
yeah,
we can get so caught up into all the rule making like Mills did. This is why I prefer to look at things as some overarching principles that I try to follow, and there may be exceptions along the way. But the problem I see with utilitarianism is that when it has been implemented in society, it's horrendous. It does terrible things to people. It's basically a call to commit a limited amount of evil in order to vanquish a larger evil. And there's all kinds of scenarios that hypotheticals that we can come up with for dealing with that. But one of the problems is the dichotomy of action is a terminology that it's always either or, and that's not the way life is. Sometimes there is that middle road.
Well, I just want to say that I believe that probably in most situations there is a best action, but that's hard to determine. But some actions are more good than others. Whatever action, an action that's closest to the best action is better than one that's farther away. And as far as bad goes, well, there are some real bad things we do, but some things are less bad than others. Like, if I just take my son's cats and give them to the animal shelter, that's bad. But if I light them on fire and let them run down the street, that's really bad. That's about as bad as I can get in terms of getting rid of my cats.
I can see in those scenarios with that. But the problem is, historically, and this is where we started with all this, is that when utilitarian principles have been put into operation by governments, it has always ended up being authoritarian and coercive. And it's not been the greatest good for the greatest number. The greatest good for the greatest number is usually redefined to being an elite. And they're not the greatest number. They're a minority, actually.
I don't think there's ever been a utilitarian society. If there was a utilitarian society...
Well, then why are we arguing about trying to create a utility? Why are we dealing with utilitarianism then as an operative ethical system when we have historical example that it hasn't worked? It always goes off the deep end because we're dealing with human beings.
You've had
a
historical example that Marxism hasn't worked.
No, Marxism hasn't worked, but it used utilitarian
I agree with you, and I said that the
American system was more utilitarian than
the Soviet system because it brought more happiness to the greatest number. So I really don't think you understand what utilitarianism is.
Well,
I think you can talk about parts of it.
The greatest good for the greatest number. Now you want to redefine that as the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Yeah. Well, now we're splitting hairs.
That is Bentham's definition, and he's the one who coined the phrase utilitarian.
Did Bentham also add voluntary to it? Or is that your addition?
Well, I'd have to look at his. But I'm trying to explain it. I'm not. First of all, Jeremy Bentham is not my God. You know, I don't have to do whatever he tells me to do.
He's rolling over in his grave.
he's not in a grave. You know, he actually decided that he would be embalmed and encased in some place wherever we could see him, like close to Parliament or some like Oxford College.
Oh, like Lenin. Perfect.
Well, you got me on that one. But it is a strange thing. But I guess he wanted to continue doing good after his death. He wanted people to see him and think about his teachings. And actually, there's this thing called the Bentham Society. I read about it today, and they meet maybe once a year, and they actually take Bentham's body in this glass case out, and they mark him as present but not voting.
Interesting.
All right. Well, is it time for me to ask and answer one of my questions, or are we talking about something that you want to keep on talking about?
Oh, you know, I guess I have a question for you.
Okay.
You know, dealing with this whole thing. Are right actions strictly determined by good consequences?
Well, I'm going to answer your question. Let me just say that when I started writing my book, I started thinking I looked into a whole bunch of ethical theories, and I started thinking that utilitarianism was probably the best rule of thumb. But then I thought, you know, there are probably some exceptions to it. And I wrote down some of these exceptions, like utilitarianism might tell you that if there are two strangers caught in a fire and your beloved mother's caught in a fire, you should rescue the two strangers because that makes two people happy rather than your beloved mother. And, you know, to me, that just doesn't seem morally right.
Because you love your mother.
Right. I mean, these strangers, you know, you don't know them. For all you know, they might not be good people or whatever. But then
would you say that you've fallen between act utilitarianism and rule utilitarianism? Or
are the rules the
exceptions?
Well, I think both have value. But I have to remind them of it. But let me just finish what I was saying. But then I kept on thinking more and more, and I thought, you know, people would be very unhappy living according to a system that said that they have to let their mother die to save two strangers in a fire. So in order to promote the greatest happiness, ironically, I would have to stray away from that very narrow interpretation of utilitarianism. So now I started off as thinking that utilitarianism is usually correct, and now I'm thinking, well, maybe it's always correct, but you know, it just the way it's applied might be a lot more tricky than Bentham had in mind, for example. I don't know. I think it's time for
maybe that's why Mill did
break.
What Mill did.
Certainly he had his reasons. All right, let me do one more commercial break. And then we'll wrap up the show. Excuse me, please.
God's a big subject. By sharing our stories, we can understand why we believe or not believe, and maybe even find some common ground. From free thought to Christianity, deism to world religions, we have something for you. Our guests include authors, philosophers, scientists, preachers, activists, and folks who have been affected by religious belief in a good or bad way. Log on to goddiscussion.net for our show schedules. There's an at-a-glance calendar there and info on our various hosts and programs. Again, that's goddiscussion.net.
Be sure to join us right here on November 4th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for a special episode of God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion. Tim Gate and I will be interviewing Linda, the World Union of Deists contact person for Scotland. On the morning of Thursday, July 7, 2005, Islamic terrorists detonated four bombs aboard three trains and one double-decker bus in London, England. As well as the four suicide bombers, 52 civilians were killed and over 700 more were injured. One of those 700 injured was Linda, who is now confined to a wheelchair for life. Linda was a lapsed Christian then, or at least that's what I think. But this tragedy propelled her to become an active deist because she realized, through both painful personal experience and rational reflection, that those who believe in absurdities can easily commit atrocities. Please tell all your friends and family to listen to her tragic and inspiring story. Since this is a live podcast, they can even ask her questions directly. Reason fixes problems, but faith causes problems, some of them very deadly. And it's not too late to call in. You can either dial 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for a quick phone call because it costs God Discussion more money than the 914 number. All right, Tim. Do you want to talk about act utilitarianism and rule utilitarianism? Do you want me to answer my question more than I did? Do you want to move on the book, or do you want to do something else?
Well, no. I'm curious as to how you fall, and if you can explain to the folks that we haven't put to sleep yet. the difference between act and rule utilitarianism.
Well, I think, you know, please correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I read about this. Rule utilitarianism is when utilitarian principles are boiled down into rules, such as don't kill, don't steal, because it's often difficult to calculate what will bring the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of people. So, you know, suppose I'm walking down the street, I might think, you know, should I get that cat out of a tree or not? You know, I have a lot of calculating to know about. But if I have a handy rule at hand, well, then I can follow that rule. And chances are I've done something at least close to bringing the greatest amount of happiness to the greatest amount of people. Act utilitarianism, this is where I'm foggy, Tim, and I may need your help. But that is basically you don't follow any rules. You just try to do the action that brings the greatest amount of happiness to the greatest amount of people. And so, you know, maybe in one case it's okay to steal, maybe in another case it's not okay to steal.
Yeah, each act is determined. Yeah, more or less, yeah. Each act is determined what one should do. It's the options are quantified and qualified, and the costs and the benefits are the attempt at calculation, and it ends up a lot of time there's it's called act, but it ends up being inactive because we're still computating as to we're figuring out our cost benefit analysis yet here on this, and so
right.
Or as
I would say
hey, cat in a tree, I'm getting it. Yeah,
I would say I'm a little bit of both. I like, for example, what I actually did, and I did this in my book Expanded Deism, is I thought to myself, what are the moral rules that I think everyone should follow, regardless of their society? And one of those is do not lie. So I think in general it's bad to lie. It does more good to tell the truth. But using act utilitarianism, I can easily come up with a situation where lying would be best. Suppose that there was this innocent child who was being chased by an axe murderer. This child ran by me and said, hide me, hide me. I said, well, go in my house. I'll close the door. And then the axe murderer comes up to me and says, hey, have you seen a little child come by here? I think the right thing to do then is to lie and say, no, I haven't. Or, hey, yeah, he went that way. And I'm pointing the wrong direction. So I think I'm a little bit of both.
Oh, that's good to know, because you're not stuck in either one, and you're attempting to actually come up with what you believe is an ethical, moral answer to the hypothetical dilemma. That's one of the questions that's used in some of these moral dilemmas is usually is placed in a police state, whether it was Soviet Union or someplace like that, Nazi Germany. And, you know, were you going to, you know, Nazi Germany, were you hiding some Jews in your attic? And, you know, Gestapo pounds on the door, and, you know, what are you going to do?
Like Kant's ethical theory, which says you shouldn't lie. You say, yeah, I got some Jews upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think
yeah.
he's
no, no, I know.
He's wrong
and this
foolish.
Is, this is, yeah, but, you know, they're a minority. I mean, the Nazis, you know, they, you know, 600,000 some Jews at that time in 1939, and the Nazis, the German people decided, not all the German people, obviously, but they decided that it'd be better off, their society would be better off without these people. And, you know, even prior to that, the doctors had been justifying euthanasia of retarded people and people with mental deficits and crippled people and various other things because of the cost-benefit analysis for the good of the whole. But anyway,
Oh, I want to give a plug to Dr. Jones. I'm going to give a plug to Michael Sandel. Have you ever heard of Michael Sandel?
No, I don't think I have. I don't remember right now.
Oh, he had this. Well, he's a philosopher professor of ethics, political ethics at Harvard University, and he had a show on PBS where they just filmed him giving his lectures, and the lectures are really interesting. It's full of things like the prisoner's dilemma and things like that. And he covers.
Oh, I know who you're talking about now. Okay. Good.
Yeah, I'm a teacher, and I get a 30-minute lunch break, and rather than talking to students or talking to colleagues, I like to listen to lectures and learn something. And all last year, I listened to this thing, this lecture series. It was called Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, and had Michael Sandel talking. And he had every
teaching company.
Sandel's teaching company.
Go ahead.
Public broadcasting.
Oh, okay. PBS.
But he's got something called Justice as a website now, and I just bought the book, and the book very much follows his lecture. But he's talking to these Harvard students, and the Harvard students are brilliant too. This guy though is smarter than them, and they're all coming up with fascinating points. Talking about individual rights versus collective needs and things like that. So I highly recommend that to anybody who's interested in justice. Go on, Tim.
Oh, well, with the concept, just a little play on words that I learned years ago when I was involved in the Patriot Law community,
Patriot
whatever,
Act, right?
That justice is just us, and that's usually what the Just Us Department is talking about. Yeah. Because justice, once again, is another one of those nebulous ethical terms like good, evil, bad. Justice is in the eye of the beholder, basically.
Well, the thing is that God is not going to tell us, what to do and what not to do. But we need to use our reason to come up with the best rules we can if we live in a society. If we live by ourselves, as you said, just do whatever you want. But most people are going to choose to live in a society.
Right, and this is where cooperation, is important. And this is where dialogue is very important, is that we can discuss ideas. And I'm not necessarily against a vote amongst people who are in a society who determine what they want to do or not want to do, as long as the person who disagrees has the opportunity to opt out without negative consequence.
Well,
if I choose I don't want to follow your rules, I'm going to leave, and you're not going to punish me for leaving.
Well,
what would be
an interesting test case on this one? I don't know. I mean, you want to walk around naked? You're
well,
naked.
I would say the other night on HBO was Muhammad Ali's greatest fight, and that was about his refusal for conscription based on his religious belief. And the U.S. Justice Department was definitely against him and after him. And it's the story of how, it's terrible, I don't remember his name, don't remember the name, I'm sorry. How he changed, he had one opinion, and one of his clerks actually changed his mind, doing thorough study and pointing out that there's an issue of law here, which actually was beneficial to the United States government per se, because it was non-precedent setting. He pointed out how they were creating two levels of justice, one for whites and one for blacks, one for Jehovah's Witnesses versus one for Nation of Islam. And he pointed out how that the court had already ruled in one case, and this is just the same thing, just different color. And
Very disturbing, isn't it?
You know, that's
our
the problem.
Our Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal, and then, you know, some people get a better break than others. You know,
well, some people are more equal than others, to paraphrase George Orwell in Animal Farm.
Absolutely. Who was, by the way, was a socialist. He was a socialist who hated communism.
Mm-hmm. He was what?
I would say that justice really exists, theoretically. I don't know if that's a contradiction.
All right.
But I would say justice really exists.
Yeah.
Justice is when people and other creatures get what they deserve. Now, of course, the debate comes as to what people deserve or what creatures deserve. And, since God is not going to come out of the sky and tell us, we got to use our brains to figure that out. So, I don't know.
Well, I agree. That's the interpretive thing of nature, because what does nature show us, or what does nature teach us? And we are part of nature, so we can't deny some of the things that we're able to understand. Nature is not always fair and just. Nature sometimes is cruel. We look at it and we interpret something as being cruel. But, you know, the mama lion is feeding her babies. Yeah, I'm sorry for the baby gazelle. But there's a law of the jungle. There's predator and prey. I mean, to me, it's best that we take a look at nature and look at what it is and what it tells us and accept things the way they are. We come up with a lot of wonderful ideas, and that's part of our natural ability with a greater frontal lobe than our ape relatives. We have an ability that's different from them. We have language. We are part of nature, and we can see things. And another aspect is we anthropomorphize a lot of things. We put human characteristics into something that doesn't necessarily have human characteristics. But we come up with these great nebulous ideas and give them a title and say, these are great ideals that everyone should do. But it's not always practical for everybody to do these things, nor does everyone want to do these things. And so we try to justify it with, you know, our rhetoric that we come up with, whether it's utilitarian or anything else.
Utilitarian, objectivist. What's another? Well, Kantian.
What? Yeah, Kant.
I want to take a moment here to criticize the revealed religion as an ethical system, because there might be a revealed religion out there, like a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, saying, you guys talk about, you know, what good and evil
is. Oh, you bunch of secular humanists talking about your Jesus is the answer. Just read the Bible.
They might be saying something like this. These guys can't agree on what good and evil is. So I'm so glad I got the Bible. Tell me what good and evil is. And, you know, if only everyone had figured it out. But I just want to read some moral commandments in the Bible. Just to show that the Bible is no sanctuary for morality, neither is the Quran. But
there you go.
I'm just going to read a few of these. I got a whole book called Bible Problems. You can get that on the World Union of Deus site. Deuteronomy chapter 21 verses 18 through 21 advocates murdering sons who are stubborn and rebellious. So if you got a kid who's a brat, you can murder him. We want to have too many American teenagers make it to their 20s.
Drag them out before the city fathers and stone them.
Deuteronomy chapter 22 verses 13 through 21 teaches that women who commit fornication should be murdered. Of course, it's not as harsh on the men. Here's one that's very disturbing. Deuteronomy chapter 22 verses 23 through 24 teaches that a rape victim should be murdered if she did not cry out for help. And this is worth, I'm going to read it. I'm going to actually read it because this is really hard to wrap a brain around, that the rape victim should be murdered if she did not cry out for help. It says, if there is a betrothed virgin and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones, the young woman because she did not cry for help though she was in the city, and the man because he violated his neighbor's wife, so you shall purge the evil from the midst of you. I just want to point out that not all rape victims cry out. In fact, some of them don't cry out because they might be murdered then.
Well, Jason,
is it worth reading one more?
You're quoting Old Testament. You're quoting Old Testament. We're New Testament people.
All right. Oh, you mean that God who burns people alive forever if they don't believe that a cosmic Jewish zombie who was his own father will save you from a curse that was caused by a rib woman who was tricked by a talking snake?
That's right. That's right. We're now in the New Testament, the New Contract, the New Covenant.
All right,
where we just have to love. All we owe to each other is to love one another.
All right,
and greet each other with a holy kiss, and do not forbid tongues.
Well, Mark chapter 4, verses 11 through 12 teaches that it's okay to be very unfair to people. I'm going to read a little commentary about this. Yahweh tricks people so much that they will not be saved. This is very unfair because people want to be saved very much. Yahweh could easily save them, and according to Christian dogma, those who are not saved will be burned alive forever. Here's Jesus talking. And Jesus said to them, to you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside, everything is in parables, so that they may indeed see, but not believe, but not perceive, and may indeed hear, but not understand, lest they should turn again and be forgiven. So here's a big jerk of a God saying, you know, I could get these guys into heaven, but I'm not going to let them understand, so they'll all go to hell. That seems evil to me.
Well, Jesus had secret knowledge, and he was just passing the secret knowledge on to his special disciples so that they would have the keys to the kingdom, and that they just, you know, he wasn't going to toss his pearls before swine, which were all the other dirty leprosy people.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, after all, remember, you know, the nine didn't thank him, but only one did after he healed him.
You know what? I find that line of argumentation unconvincing. I suppose you do too.
Yeah. Revealed religions and their attempt at morality. All one has to do is look at the Old Testament and just the ridiculousness of Mosaic law. Whether or not as a Christian, a so-called New Testament Christian, you believe that the Old Testament applies or doesn't apply. I mean, you got so many different Christian congregations out there that some believe in parts of the Old Testament, some believe that all the Old Testament's passed away, some believe that you should follow the Old Testament laws regardless of Christianity, even though you have become a Christian, you should follow. I mean, if you're uncircumcised as a man, you become a Christian, you should follow the example of Paul and Timothy and go and get circumcised. I mean, and even the Apostle Paul contradicts himself in numerous places where he says kind of do one thing but then do something else. And it's convoluted and confusing, and it ends up being a whole set of rules with subsets of rules and then a whole bunch of exceptions. And who can follow that?
Reason is
nobody can follow it.
Clear voice.
Yeah.
Reason says so, this is nonsense. I'll think for myself.
Primarily, and that's the role of the individual, and this is why I'm such an individualist as opposed to a collectivist. I believe in working together with people on a voluntary level. But if you try to coerce me into working together, my first reaction is going to be resistance. I will consider it, but I'm not necessarily going to go along with it. And that's the problem,
well,
Jason. I have with utilitarianism in principle.
Well, Tim, I will let you get the last word in because it's time to end the show about.
Oh, is it really? Okay, I'll say this. This is my last word.
Okay.
If theory utilitarianism is a compromise for the greater good, it can do good things like help the poor and save lives, but in practice it becomes the ultimate act of hubris. It justifies human sacrifices in the names of false gods. We're all flawed thinkers, but it assumes perfect information. It carries a great potential for evil and should be handled like plutonium. It can improve things when used responsibly, but when combined with ignorance, it makes the world far worse.
Well, I could say something about the law of the jungle, but we're almost out of time, and I did say you could have the last word. So I'm just going to end by saying I want to thank my co-host, Tim, for helping me.
Thank you, Jason.
Feel free to – you're welcome, sir. Feel free to email me at jason@deism.com. That's J-A-Y-S-O-N at D-E-I-S-M.com. And remember that God gave us reason, not religion.
Hope you enjoyed this presentation. To learn more about deism, please visit www.deism.com. That's deism.com. And visit goddiscussion.com for the latest church and state news, articles, and opinions. The comments and opinions in this broadcast are respected, but do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of other hosts, guests, and/or goddiscussion.com.
Frightening number of Americans think that man coexisted with dinosaurs 6,000 years ago, where church and state are headed for a collision course. You've got one new source that covers it all, GodDiscussion.com. Go there, comment, bookmark it, spread the word, engage. GodDiscussion.com.